this case.
Presbyterian.
This is tape one, side two. Okay, so it's something, one of the big medical schools in New York City.
Yeah.
Okay.
And his son.
Columbia Presbyterian. There's something called that.
That's probably what it is.
Yeah, okay.
And he, this younger Tandorf, works in medical acoustics. Now, anyway, we went to the clinic and took our sketches in our arm, and then he brought clients that he had under treatment in his clinic, and then made a very, very, I should say, depressing experience. You see, that was Nazi times, and he had these inheritance laws. Inheritance, or what would you call it?
Inheritance? No. Nothing to do with family endowment. You mean what, your genetic testing?
Yeah, in medical terms.
Inheritance.
You call it inheritance. Yeah.
It can be called inheritance tests and studies of genetics, characteristics acquired through the bloodline. Is this
mm-hmm.
what you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Yeah, yeah. I don't know what the actual term is.
No, the bad story was that there was certain laws, yeah, that the state could intervene, yeah, in such families. For instance, that they wouldn't get any more children or something.
Yep. Yep. That's
and there was a client, a woman who had a very severe hearing problem, and her first child had it too, and she was pregnant. And they didn't have the means to do a check on the nature of this hearing damage, as well in the mother as in the child. And unfortunately, we could do it with my instrument. You see, we got exactly the same pattern of hearing deficiency. And what do you say? He had to report this to authorities, Nazi authorities, and this baby was aborted on the grounds of my measurements.
Is this eugenics? Is that the term?
Probably so, yeah.
Producing.
Yeah.
Improving the breed. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't allow. Yep, that's it.
Mm-hmm. You can imagine I was a young fellow, yeah, and then made a terrific impression on me.
Were you happy that you were not in medicine at that time?
In a certain way, yes.
Yes.
Yes. There was another thing which I learned in connection with this hearing testing, that the background in physics of these young doctors was so poor, and that medicine, no.
Mm. Yeah. It was not a world you wanted to be in. Well, we should move along here.
Yeah.
You were in physics, in engineering physics.
Right.
You were getting your master's degree, your diploma. What were your plans?
I even made money on that.
You made money on the hearing clinic?
On the thesis.
On the thesis. How did you make money on that?
Each year, the Association of Hearing Doctors had a competition or contest or... What do you call it? You had to write a essay for...
a prize essay. Yeah.
A prize essay. And together with his assistant professor, I wrote my prize essay on this hearing gadget I built and what experience we had. And we made the prize. This was 1,000 marks. It was a lot of money at the
4,000 marks?
1,000.
1,000 marks. And these were Reichsmarks.
Reichsmark, yeah.
Okay. Was that a... how long could you live on that? That must have been a lot.
I put it in the bank, yeah, for later purposes.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were your immediate plans?
Now, of course, I wanted to go ahead with the doctorate. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And because of the economic circumstances in the beginning of the Nazi Reich, our professor Barkhausen said, I don't let you work on your doctorate, you go into industry and see that you get your feet on the ground. nobody knows how long this boom will last, and you better be in. So I left the university and went to Siemens.
Was it safer to be in industry than in university?
Oh, yeah.
Why is that?
Because industry at that time made money, and universities didn't.
Okay. It wasn't a question of war production, or...
Not at that time.
No. Okay. Were you being looked at for the Army? Was there any pressure?
Not at that time, no.
Okay. So you went to Siemens?
Even we were lucky. Of course, the students were more or less pressed in these Nazi student organizations. But since we were in the status of getting the final examination, we were exempted. So I got around this bad thing.
I see. Just barely.
Yeah.
How did you go to Siemens? Was that the only choice? Was that the choice of Backhausen for you?
Essentially, I was 1 year at Siemens when I interrupted my university studies. You see, for our examination, we were required to work for 1 year in an industrial
outfit. Yeah. So that's an apprenticeship of some sort.
Yeah, you may call that.
Okay.
And by good circumstances, I could go to Siemens for this year, which was very beneficial for my training. And it was more or less natural that I went back to Siemens after.
Understood. What did you do during the summers? Did you have summer vacations?
Oh, yeah.
And what did you find that you did during your years at university?
Well, you see, you were supposed to work pretty much on your own.
Still studying.
So it was mostly 3 months in summertime that we worked up with what we were studying on in the previous semester.
Okay. So you continued reading and continued doing experimentation?
Not so much experimentation. It was mainly paperwork.
Paperwork.
I like to mention that because you asked the question of whether I was in the practical side or theoretical, I had 6 semesters of theoretical physics.
You mentioned Heisenberg and Debye and things like that. Mm.
Töpler, I don't know whether that means anything to
Who?
You. Töpler.
No. Could you spell it?
T-O-E-P-L-E-R.
No, it doesn't immediately hit.
And the father of Töpler was also a professor of physics. And he became famous with his electrostatic experiments. How should I describe it? He had quite a name, Töpler, the older Töpler.
Mm-hmm. Early Van de Graaff type generators and studying static charge and
physics. He particularly studied discharges.
Discharges, yeah.
So-called Töpler patterns. You will find in old physics books. But you see, there was pretty much demand for our graduate studies in theoretical physics.
Yeah. What were your duties at Siemens? Let's move on to Siemens then.
I wanted to go in an acoustic laboratory, but I didn't make it for certain reasons. And I was assigned to a laboratory for measuring gadgets, particularly for telecommunication. It's a very interesting field.
Is that the official name, Laboratory for Measuring Gadgets?
You see, in German we distinguish between Messinstrument and Messgerät.
The first one is a measuring instrument, and what's the second one?
Test.
You see, the measuring instrument is, for instance, a voltmeter or ammeter or ohmmeter. Yeah?
Yeah.
That's the instrument. But the Gerät is a set of, or let's say, a circuitry.
Yes.
For instance, we measured the capacity of telecommunication cables.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you need a certain kind of a bridge, particularly so-called Wien bridge, and things like that. But we built much more sophisticated things just like that.
I see. Sophisticated test equipment that was designed to test systems.
Right.
Yes. Okay.
And that was, for me, it was very educational, you see.
Yeah. What year was this when you got...
I started in January of 35 with Siemens.
Okay. And how long did you work with them?
Well, then they had internal reorganizations. They had very bad luck. It was a time when they built up the German Air Force, mm-hmm. and three of the top engineers of the laboratories died in an air crash for testing out Messgeräte in an airplane. And so they had internal problems with finding proper replacements. So I was transferred to another laboratory for replacement of one of the guys who died. And it was in multiplexing telegraphy.
I see. Multiplexing, yeah.
Now I got acquainted with entirely different aspects of electronics, this whole filter building, filter theory. And
filter theory, exactly.
And receiver design and things like that.
In this system, was this actually telemetry type material? This was radio, or was this all wire by wire, multiplexing by wire?
Essentially wire, but telemetry, my first encounter with telemetry was I had to make a design for a telemetric system for the power plants in Morocco.
How did that come out, or come about, I should say?
Well, of course, Morocco is an area of long distances, yeah, and they had the power plants in all directions of wind, and they wanted to have a central control on the production of energy, mm-hmm. so they needed a telemetering system. Mm-hmm. And that tied in our multiplexing telegraphy systems. We could use elements of the telegraphy, multiplexing telegraphy, for this telemetering system.
Mm-hmm. And that's really interesting. Was this when Morocco was under German occupation?
No, this is
a way.
I think it was still French at the time.
It was French. So this was a commercial venture with Siemens.
Right.
Okay, fine. Was Siemens becoming more and more a military contractor while you were working there?
Of course, yeah. Another thing we were working on was the remote control of a battleship for target practicing for the naval artillery.
Uh-huh.
See, it was an unmanned ship, no ship, no battleship, and everything was automated on the ship.
So you were getting familiar with servo control mechanms and feedback?
Of course, I was essentially concerned with the electronic part of it.
Yeah.
Signal transmitting, command transmitting, and things like that.
How extensive did that become? Did these ships become quite controllable by remote
control? Yeah.
It became not an experimental, but a operations.
No, the practiced sharpshooting, heavy artillery and
oh,
heavy
I know
ships.
They knew how to shoot, but I'm wondering if how well the control really worked. Could you really make the ships behave as you wanted?
Oh, yeah. And then we had the feedback of the hits, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Which parts were hit, yeah.
Uh-huh. Was that interesting work?
Oh, my goodness.
yeah, it must have been.
Now, all this stuff helped me very much for my job then in Peenemünde.
Well, let's identify. Is it the right time to identify how you got to Peenemünde?
Yeah, see, I stayed at Siemens for not quite 3 years.
Okay. That would bring you up to about 38, 1938?
37.
Okay. The reason why I'm trying to identify a date is that a very important date in Regener's life was his signing of the Heisenberg-Wien-Geiger memorandum. And I want to ask you if you had any knowledge of the problems that were going on, Aryan physics and
no,
the reaction
we didn't
against
have,
it.
No, have much knowledge. I could have probably, because a friend of mine, a schoolmate, stayed with Heisenberg. He got his doctorate with Heisenberg. Mm-hmm. And he was very close to Weizsäcker.
Carl
Friedrich von Weizsäcker.
Von Weizsäcker, yeah.
I met him in Leipzig, in Heisenberg's Institute. And
But that was not in your experience. You weren't involved in that problem.
No.
Okay. But you mentioned your father lost his job around this
time.
Yeah. Why was that? Was he political?
Because he wasn't a Nazi. Of course, and it was known that this institute he was a professor at was known to be very liberal.
Mm-hmm. Did he suffer personally?
Oh, yeah. And my mother almost more than my father.
Physically, then?
No, mentally. Yeah.
Mentally. Hmm. Did they survive the war?
Yeah. And my father was offered to be a principal of a school, and he declined it. He said, I had enough.
What did he do then when he lost his profession?
He went into retirement.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I mean, he was not very far off from retirement. And
was he able then to support, I mean, the retirement was enough to, he had an income?
Yeah.
And they were secure, you didn't have to support them?
No, that's
okay.
The retirement pay is pretty good in Germany.
Yeah. So he maintained a retirement, he wasn't ostracized completely, lost that. Okay, that's good. Well, let's identify the process through which you came under the Peenemünde work. Did you actually go directly to Peenemünde, but it sounds like you came on just as Peenemünde was being built, or what?
I was for a very short time in Kummersdorf.
Yeah.
Which was the first installation of Domberg and Braun.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was the actual process? How did you get onto the Peenemünde team? Did you know any of these people? How did you know them?
A friend of ours from school, this Dr. Hermann, who was the chief aerodynamicist in Peenemünde. He was a number of years older than I was.
H-E-R-R-M-A-N-N?
H-E-R-M-A-N-N, yeah.
Okay.
And we stayed in contact, and his father was my music teacher in the gymnasium.
Small world.
And we had some connection to a youth group.
How did he come to choose you?
Now, of course, they were looking for personnel in this building up phase, yeah. And he knew that I was interested in measuring techniques, yeah, from my diploma work and Siemens work and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed a chairman or chief of the measuring department in Peenemünde.
Mm-hmm.
So he suggested me to Werner von Braun, but he didn't take me right away. But he sent me to a professor in the Technical University in Hannover.
In Hanover?
Hanover, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
This professor was already working for Peenemünde on a contract. And I had a day's scrutinizing or what.
Was he examining you, looking at
in a very elegant way.
Sort of a viber, as they would do, talking with you and
sure.
Getting an idea of what
he
kind of
he took me
person.
Through all his laboratories. They were very interesting. And I remember that, you are coming from Barkhausen, so the only thing you know is electronics. How about physics? And we discussed his physical experiment. And said, you know about physics.
good. I see.
That made it.
Mm-hmm. Well, after that, was it a long time before you knew, or did you find out immediately?
No, within days.
Within days?
I think within a week or so.
Okay. So how did you move to Kummersdorf? Is that a great distance? Or did you have a family by then? You were still pretty young.
I just married at that time. And I was assigned to Kummersdorf because they were still in the phase of building concrete blockhouses and things like that in Peenemünde, and I couldn't do much yet. The concrete was still wet and we couldn't put our instrumentation in.
Mm-hmm.
So I was assigned to Kummersdorf, to the old installation for, it was a short time, a couple of months or something like that.
And you were to be chief of measuring devices.
Right.
Measuring devices to measure the behavior of the missiles reconnaissance of
At that time, we essentially were concerned with the development of the rocket motors.
Of the rocket motors, okay. Let me ask you a few questions from Frank Winter's list. The first question, I think, relates to rocket motors and other things. At this time, or at any time before you came to Peenemünde, or at Peenemünde, do you have any knowledge that any of Robert Goddard's patents or writings were ever examined by you or used at Peenemünde towards the V-2 or other the rocket developments?
That's a very strange thing. We knew of the existence of Goddard, but we had the slightest idea what he did. And we didn't get hold of any of his papers. And after we came over here, we found out that we did quite a few things in parallel.
Mm-hmm. But you never saw Goddard's technical papers at this time?
No.
Okay. Did you... So how would you characterize Goddard's influence or input to German rocket development, certainly in this early years?
It was about nil.
Nil.
We esteemed him very highly. We had a very, very good impression of his work and his ideas.
Of course, you've probably read American histories of rocketry that say that Goddard's, you know, the Germans were very interested in Goddard's work and the Russians were very interested in Goddard's work and read his papers and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What is your general comment about American writing on the influence of Goddard in rocketry, in the history of rocketry? Do you have any personal comments or opinions?
I said we didn't know in Germany what he did.
Mm. Well, I think that's pretty straightforward. Okay.
It's just a lack of knowledge.
Okay. Let's go back then to your specific duties. Were you briefed by Wernher von Braun? How much contact did you have with Dornberger? What kind of circles did you run in, and what were your initial duties and responsibilities?
Well, set up the measuring systems for these rocket motor tests,
mm-hmm.
Which was in certain ways unique, because the instrumentation you could buy from industry didn't suffice in many cases to our requirements.
Because of the conditions of operation of a rocket motor?
For instance, flow measurements, measuring the rate of flow of the propellants.
Mm-hmm.
There were no instruments available which could take such large rates. So we had to initiate development in industry. And
mm-hmm. Did you go directly to industry and offer money, or were you a liaison for contract work?
No, we are everything at the same time.
Everything at the same time, yeah. Did you have specialists working for you who were contract people, grants and risks, you know, type people as we have here, and then technical officers who could maintain some vigil, some contact with industry to make sure they were doing things to specifications?
Yeah, of course I had a staff. I don't know how large my group was at that time, from academic personnel down to workmen.
Did you hire? You were the hiring agent?
Oh, yeah, for my group at least. Yeah.
Right. How did you recruit yourself?
It was very difficult, because there was, at that time already, such a shortage of technical personnel. You really had to go around and look and sometimes sneak away at the people from their employers, for instance, from Siemens. Yeah.
So you conducted periodic manpower raids.
Okay. More or less. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was that very common in all of the German research and development areas, that they were short of manpower?
The only thing you could do, yeah. That's
did you feel, though, that you were being given support by the military? Was this project a favored project, or did you have to really scrounge?
No, that was the pleasant thing in Peenemünde, that we never had to talk about money.
Mm-hmm.
The most difficult problem was manpower, to get the manpower together.
Just ask, when you joined von Braun and Dornsberg at Kummersdorf, did you have to become a member of the army or a member of the party at that time?
Not of the army. We were civilian employees of the army or of the German government. And later on in Peenemünde, we were more or less forced to become party members.
Mm-hmm. About when? Was that already in the 40s?
38 or so.
That early, in 38. Okay. So you had to sign up. Yeah. How did you feel about that? How did your colleagues feel about that?
Well, we more or less neglected it. You see, we felt a kind of protected by the military organization. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
At that time, the party doesn't have any say so whatever in army affairs, in military affairs.
Yeah.
So it was more or less a formality of us.
Yet you had to sign up. That was an indication of the party, the power of the party, to at least require that you do that. Yeah. Martin, did you have something? Okay. Can you describe which rocket engines you were working on at the first? The A5, I know, was built in the late 30s. The A3.
Now, the very first one was the A3.
The A3.
That was my first assignment.
Mm-hmm.
When still the concrete was wet in the test stands, yeah, and von Braun wanted to make a good use of me, and one day he telephoned me from Berlin. You see, Dornberger was actually located in Berlin.
Yes.
In the Ordnance Department, yeah. And he came on a certain regular schedule to Peenemünde to look after us.
Mm-hmm.
And so he called me on the telephone and said, well, you know, we are scheduled to have the first rocket firing of the A3 missile.
Mm.
I don't know whether these missiles mean anything to you.
I know a little bit about them, yeah. Okay, Dr. Reisig has brought out a blue binder with a manuscript in it. Could you identify the manuscript we're looking at?
Oh, well, that's the first part of my Salzburg talk on the development of the Apollo rocket with the Peenemünde concepts.
Yes, we have a copy of this. You, I believe, gave us part of this, didn't you already?
Sophie made a copy for
Sophie
herself.
Did. That's right. Okay. We want to make sure we do.
Yeah, that's the outline of the first.
This is the A3.
A3.
Okay.
This very slender and with these long fins here.
Yeah, picture number two, Versuchs Rakete A3, Peenemünde 1937. Yes, I've seen photographs of this being launched. This is the photograph, that's right.
Yeah.
Picture three.
This is on a test stand in Kummersdorf.
Okay, that's picture four. Yes, Kummersdorf, 1937. Do you have the original prints of these pictures? Are these your own pictures?
No, the originals are in the Deutsche Museum.
In the Deutsche Museum, okay, fine.
And von Braun made me the manager of this first missile firing.
Now, was that part of your general assignment? I mean, you were chief of measurement instruments.
Yeah.
How was this an add-on assignment, or did it go along with your regular duties?
That was a special assignment.
Mm.
And it was not even in Peenemünde, but it was in a little island.
In Greifswalder Oy?
Greifswalder Oy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now this, you're opening, this is Dornberger's book, V2.
Yeah.
I'm just saying this for the tape record.
Oh. Here's the same picture.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is figure, it's not numbered, darn. This is in the beginning of the book. Let's try to figure out what page number it faces. Oh, and this is actually in the very beginning, just after the foreword, page XVI, 16. Okay, so it's two pages on beyond that. So that test stand on that small island must have been very, very new. Was that the main launch, the Peenemünde launch site, off Usedom
Island? In the beginning, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, it doesn't even show here. Oh, yeah, you see here, this little dot. That's the Greifswalder Oyer. Is the Peenemünde is here on this tip of this island there?
Yes. Yeah. And this is, we're looking at map facing page 3, and it's a little inset called Rügen, R-U-U-M-L-A-U-G-E-N.
Rügen is this island here.
It's an island. And, just
and this little dot here is the Greifswalder Oyer.
Okay. Yeah, between.
A tiny island.
Very tiny. Inside a square. Did that square or rectangle area indicate the firing area then? Or is that the area indicated here?
Actually, should be in. Here it is.
Yes. Okay, it's. There it is. Okay. Yep. Very small island.
Mm-hmm.
Not all. Did all the launches take place there?
No. At least these three firings.
Okay. Because I know later on that the rockets that Regener was to have his instruments on and the vertical firings that von Braun did were from the Greifswalder Oy.
Yeah, Greifswalder.
Greifswald. Okay, sorry. Sorry.
And you couldn't imagine how primitive that all was.
How did you like living up there? How did your wife like living up there?
She stayed for a week, I think, with me, and then she gave up. Now, it was winter time, December, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine how the...
And she went back to the Leipzig area?
No, to our house in Peenemünde. Yeah.
Oh, in Peenemünde. So Peenemünde was okay.
Yeah.
But the island was really raw.
Yeah.
Okay, understood. So you became the project manager, in a way, for launching the A3s.
Right.
Was that, did that include evaluation and testing?
A certain evaluation, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned to me in one of some of the earlier letters that you flew scientific instruments for measuring height and that sort of thing, thermographs, barographs.
I have some documents in that.
Excellent. Me. Who designed those? Did you have a part in designing those?
No, instruments? See, when I came to Peenemünde then from Kummersdorf, these things were already more or less ready for firing.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't participate in the development of any of the gadgets. And
how high up did these go?
Well, we had the very bad luck with these firings because that was the first rocket with a full control system, automatic control, and this control system fizzled.
This is the stabilization system?
Right.
Yeah. Was it fin stabilized or the little rudder feedback systems
there
in
were,
the exhaust
you
like the V2?
You can see it here. There were molybdenum rudders in the exhaust.
Molybdenum. At least I'm trying to do that for the transcriber.
I don't know how you call it.
Is that right?
Molybdenum.
Yeah. NUM.
Yeah, that shouldn't it.
Fine. Okay. Okay. Yeah. NUM. Okay. So there were those little veins.
Yeah.
There,
yeah.
And there was a stabilization system then.
Right.
That mm-hmm. drove those veins. And you say it fizzled.
Yeah.
Do you know why?
Well, it had several reasons. The basic physical concept was wrong of the whole system. It's a very interesting story, by the way. And I'm now writing the second part of this, which is, this is here propulsion, yeah? And the second part is control.
Okay, we don't want to duplicate what you're already writing in
yeah.
the interview. What we want to do is fill in the human aspect of
yeah.
things that you may not include or that we would like to flesh out. In other words, what was the spirit, the working spirit, the atmosphere for research? What did you do in your spare time? What was it like working at Peenemünde?
It was always exciting. Mm-hmm. I said that in another speech already, that I can't remember a single day in Peenemünde that was not exciting or at least interesting. Because something always was up here, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly with this spirit or mentality of von Braun. Yeah? He generated idea like I don't know what.
Okay. What about the military? How
evident was the German army there?
Very little.
Very little. It changed later on, I take it.
Yes and no. It changed with regard to the SS, but not actually to the army.
Okay, yeah, certainly with the SS. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me ask a few of the particular questions also that Frank Winter has prepared. Mm-hmm. At this point, I think is appropriate also. Were you a member of the wartime GFW Space Flight Advocate Group, as was Kraft Erika?
What is that?
Well, he described it, GFW, capital...
Is that Gesellschaft for...
Weltraumforschung.
Okay.
No, that was not wartime.
Was that pre-war? Were you involved at all in it?
No.
Okay. So, for the record, that's a no for question number three. Well, I'll go back. I think we've identified that you were not, you had some awareness of space flight through Oberth, but did you increase in your awareness or interest in the 30s at all before you went to Peenemünde?
Well, in a certain way, of course it was top secret almost, but you see, our friends talked together, yeah. So I got some ideas what was going on. Mm-hmm. And of course...
Was it exciting because it was the way to go to the moon, or were you...
Yeah, of course. At least at that time, we were pretty quickly caught by the idea of going into space. And that was a tremendous impetus in doing work on it.
But there was no question that you were developing a military capability.
Not at all.
What do you mean, not at all?
Well, I didn't even know that it was supposed to be employed as a weapon, yeah? Because we thought, oh, that's so far away that it ever can be used as a weapon. Yeah?
So did you ever ask yourself why the German army was supporting this?
Yeah, well, in the long-range proposition, yes, yeah. But not immediately. Yeah. There were so many basic problems to be solved,
yeah,
that the military aspect was second, third priority.
Did you believe, or were you comfortable in the fact that Germany was at war, it was to be a 1,000-year empire, and that there would be room, plenty of time for experimentation to bring these things up to operational
status? Yeah, when I started, there was no war. There was, mm-hmm, well, before the war, 2 years before the war. Yeah.
So it was a purely experimental, blue sky sort of an operation, mm-hmm, in your mind. Real long range, as far as time was concerned. No specific things, nothing about the Versailles Treaty or anything like that came into your mind, at least. Okay, you're shaking your head no. I'm just saying that for the tape.
Sorry.
Okay. Did you have any knowledge of Carlotto Altvater? And could you tell us anything of his role as a link between the old VFR and Peenemünde?
May I see the
sure.
name, please?
It's question number five.
Carl Otto Altvater, of course I knew Altvater. He was one of the Siemens managers, fairly high up. Hmm. He was a former Navy captain. Mm-hmm. And I met him only in Peenemünde. I didn't know him before.
So you did meet him in Peenemünde?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was he there as a consultant, or what capacity, do you know?
You see, we had a Siemens team with us in Peenemünde for the development of an improved control system.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And he came sporadically to Peenemünde to look after his people and talk with us. And
Would you say that he made a major contribution to the Peenemünde effort?
Well, in terms that he was very favorable of us.
He was very?
Favorable. Mm-hmm. You see, we had quite a number of people who said, oh, all these guys are crazy. And he took us serious.
Who thought you were crazy? Anybody we know?
Well, I should say essentially in the army circles. I mean.
In the army, yeah. Okay, let me change the tape.
Mm-hmm.